All right, we're ready to go and ready to roll. This is Ross Heide of the Lutheran History Center of the West with a chance to interview a rather interesting fellow, Scott Hasseruth, Executive Director of Holden Village, probably one of the most fascinating places in Lutheranism in the United States. Scott, you were a little lad, I guess, when I was in Berkeley in 49, 50.
That's right.
Where were you in school in those years?
Well, I in 49, I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
Can't tell you what grade that was.
Yeah.
But my parents settled in Berkeley after, well, during the war years. My father enlisted in the Navy, and they had lived there before. He'd been transferred to the East Coast, and then when the war came along, he ended up in the Pacific, and so they decided to settle again in Berkeley.
Were you a part of Bethany Lutheran Church?
Right.
Who was
right?
Pastor, you remember
well,
that?
Well, my boyhood pastor was Carl B. Anderson, and I remember him, of course, with great fondness.
Yeah.
And then Philip Ellman
yeah.
Came along after he did.
Came from Augustana, Portland.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, I guess during my college and seminary years, Ken Senft was there. And, so you would have been there during the time that Carl B. was
yes,
there.
Yes, Carl B. was my neighbor, and I left before Phil came.
Right.
How did you happen to go back to St. Olaf to go to college?
Well, when I graduated from Berkeley High School, staying in Berkeley meant going to UC Berkeley, and I knew that I didn't want to do that. And St. Olaf seemed like as good a place to go as any. My father had graduated from there, and it was a chance to get in touch with my own Scandinavian roots, and so that's where I ended up.
Had you learned Norwegian there?
No. My father spoke Norwegian, but my mother was fluent in Swahili. We actually had more Swahili around the household than we did Norwegian when I was growing up.
She had lived in Africa, hadn't she?
She grew up in Kenya.
Uh-huh.
Her parents were farmers, pioneers. But my father would get together with his Norwegian friends, and they cooked this god-awful stuff called lutefisk.
Yeah.
And my mother learned how to make lefse, and then they'd sit around and talk Norwegian. So I got to hear a little bit of it, but never studied it until I went to Norway some years later.
I see. Well, now you did your seminary work in Berkeley at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary.
Right, after St. Olaf, and then I later went back and did further studies at San Francisco Theological Seminary.
I see, and that was toward the D-Med?
D-Med degree, right.
What emphasis and what was your thesis?
My interest then, and still is in many ways, in the whole integration of psychology and theology.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked on some issues relevant to that concern.
What were they?
Well, you put me on the spot. My interest was in examining several central theological assertions that are a part of our faith and trying to correlate those with a scale I was using on mental health. It's the inventory is called the POI, and it's built on some of the stuff that people like Rogers and Fritz Perl and others have done, and their whole definition of self-realization. My thesis was that if you had a fairly balanced and in fact rather orthodox Christian theological view, that you'd actually be pretty healthy on their self-realization scale, as opposed to if you subscribe to some theological notions that are really not very orthodox. For example, one of the assertions I made in the dissertation was that most people still have a docetic view of Jesus rather than a balanced view of Jesus. They really see Jesus as exclusively a divine figure and not as a figure that's not only divine but also a human being. And the people with a balanced view, the thing I was trying to test out, what I felt would also come out higher on the POI inventory. And in fact, they did. But, researchers like to make things come out how they want. So, but it was an interesting thesis to kind of play around with. So what I was trying to say was that theological health and psychological health can fit together quite nicely.
That was a challenging thesis. Right. Was it in that field that you taught at Fuller Seminary?
No. That started in my seminary days with an interest in Carl Jung. And during those days, I became involved with a group in San Francisco called the Guild for Psychological Studies.
Oh, yeah.
And their retreat center called Four Springs. Mm-hmm. Came involved in my own analysis, and I really regard my own analysis as one of the most significant aspects of my education as a mm-hmm. person. And that led me ultimately to want to take a year out and then do nothing but read and study Jung and study his implications for understanding contemporary spirituality and so forth. So in 1980, our family took a year off and went to Zurich, Switzerland, and lived there, and I studied there. My wife studied there as well. My teaching began at Fuller in the mid-70s when the psychology school at Fuller. Fuller has three schools under one umbrella. There's School of Missions, which is a very fine School of Missions. There's School of Theology, and there's Psych School, which offers a PhD in clinical psych. And they were looking for someone to teach classes in analytic psych and its contribution to not only psychology, but its implications for doing theology. So that was what I did at Fuller.
How long were you there with them?
About 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. As an adjunct.
Was that why you were in the parish in Pasadena?
Right, yeah.
What church was it in Pasadena?
Messiah.
Oh,
Lutheran.
Yeah. There's Trinity, the old ULC, and then Messiah.
Right. The world is small, you know, and Carl B. Anderson, who was my boyhood pastor, when he left Bethany, went to Messiah in Pasadena.
Yeah.
And so here I am years later ending up in that parish.
With his wife with you.
Right, yeah. His widow was there in the parish. And then my neighboring colleague was Ken Semt at Trinity Lutheran Church.
Yes, who
had been my pastor when I was in college and seminary days. Right.
That was when they put together the merger of the Berkeley churches, wasn't it?
Right, yeah. Became ultimately Lutheran Church of the Cross. And
how long did you stay in Pasadena? You went over to Arizona?
We were in Pasadena for 12 years. When I came, Messiah was an aging parish. It had Augustana, you know, Swedish roots, and many older people still in the parish from those days. The parish had really peaked during Carl B's days there, and then it had begun to go downhill as the community became increasingly more multiracial and more multicultural, and actually ended up in a kind of a poor section of town. So I think the average age was about 70 when Jeanette and I arrived. So the challenge was to build a multiracial cultural parish with much broader ages, that was an exciting ministry. I see that in many ways as a very pivotal period of my life.
Yeah, you pastors had that challenge, and some of you were able to do it effectively.
Yeah.
Was the work with the elderly housing started while you were there?
No, that was when Carl B. was there as well.
Uh-huh.
He was the sort of physical builder of the parish, and the project, though, was not successful, Well, I shouldn't say it wasn't successful. I mean, the end result was good. But the hope was, of course, the congregation created a separate corporation to build these units of independent living, and got into trouble with it financially, and California Lutheran Homes bought the facility and has operated it since very successfully. So that the goal of Congregation in Mind was ultimately achieved, and probably under a better structure than if the congregation had run itself. So I think there were some real people of vision there. They just didn't quite have all the numbers straight when they built it. And it functions to this day, and functions in a very neat
way. I visited it a few years ago. Yeah. Our daughter lived right around the corner.
Oh, really?
Church. Oh. Uh-huh. She's studying down there. Mm-hmm. So I did get to see it.
Yeah.
I was curious as to how you happened to go to Norway.
Well, when we were in Zurich, we joined the local English-speaking congregation, and in most of the European cities, they have English-speaking, international, interdenominational parishes, and we found that a really delightful fellowship. I really enjoyed that a lot. Mm-hmm. And people who lived all over the world, people from all over the world, from many different Christian traditions, from Africa, from Europe, from the United States, Canada, Australia, from Asia, you know, that kind of, I suppose, is what started our thinking about, well, maybe someday down the road, you know, maybe that would be an interesting ministry to participate in.
What avenue of contact did you use there? Or did they find you, or did you let them know of your interest?
Well, the Stavanger congregation found us. They found us through the pastor who had been in Zurich and who was a part of that network.
I see. That church in Stavanger is related officially to what body?
Well, it's like the congregations in Zurich. It has no relation to any body. It's a completely congregational congregation in the sense that it's a freestanding, autonomous congregation, as are most of these international congregations. Now, they do have a link together through an association in Europe and the Middle East. The ones in Europe and the Middle East, the ones in Asia also have an organization and so forth. And all those congregations tend to use an office of the National Council of Churches called the Division for Overseas Ministries.
Is the ELCA a part of that?
ELCA? Well, that group is in touch with denominational officers.
Okay.
When there are vacancies in this congregation, and these congregations are seeking candidates. So that's the normal route for anyone who's interested in those ministries, would be to get in touch with their denominational officer or department, or get in touch directly with the Division for Overseas Ministries. Art Bauer is currently the director of that. He's a good Lutheran.
Oh, yeah. And, I know Art, yeah. He used to be in the Foreign Missions or Overseas Mission.
Right.
Or World Ministry, they call it, World Ministry. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your experience. How long were you at Stavanger?
Well, we were in Stavanger for 3 years. I should say we went from Pasadena to Phoenix. We were there almost 5 years in Phoenix.
What parish in Phoenix?
At Faith Lutheran.
You were at Faith?
Right.
Paul Klutz?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was there during the heyday of Faith. It seemed to be my calling in life to take on parishes that had experienced their heydays and had been declining for some time. And
tough challenge.
And the challenge was to kind of get them back on the track again. And that was once the flagship of the old ULC.
And Grace.
That and Grace, yeah. Grace was the mother church.
That's right.
And then Faith came along. Yeah, Faith was the second church founded in Arizona. Grew to a rather substantial size, and then Phoenix grew in rings, and so churches were planted a mile in every direction, and the congregation, of course, began to decrease in size. Anyway, that was a delightful ministry. That's a wonderful congregation in the center of Phoenix, and we enjoyed our years there too. And it was while we were there that the call came to go to Norway.
Apparently your wife was willing, enthusiastic too?
Well, she was actually probably pushed me into it more. I had some real hesitations. We just finished a major building program at Faith, and things were going well, and I thought, gee, you know, now's not the time to leave, you know. Now's the time to stay and enjoy some of the
Fruits of life's labors, man.
But, and I remember talking with our bishop then, Stan Olson, and about this, and that was also his boyhood parish, you know, was mm-hmm. faith. And his counsel to me, which I think was good, was that that many pastors had desired to serve an overseas parish, but they always said, well, you know, when I get to be such and such an age, or when my kids get through school, or, you know, or when the dog dies and the last yeah. kid leaves home, and
right.
Or when my wife retires or something, and consequently they never do it. And that if you're going to do it, you need to do it when the opportunity is there before you. Otherwise, it probably won't happen for you. And
what time of year did you go over there?
We went in the summer.
Uh-huh.
And spent three delightful years in Stavanger, Norway, which is south of Bergen way. And in a parish that's was not as diverse as the Zurich one, but it was. But it did include the people from many places in Europe, the refugees, Norwegians. The largest group, of course, came from the United States, and then there was a significant group of people from Canada, and a significant number from Britain, from England.
I see.
And came from all traditions. Lutherans were very much in the minority. Probably the largest percentage of the congregation was Presbyterian and Methodist.
Uh-huh.
But from all traditions, including Roman Catholics.
Is that right?
So these congregations are fascinating. I think that this is a tremendous arena of mission and ministry. English is now, rightly or wrongly, English is becoming the international language.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, for example, we had German people in Norway who understood English but not Norwegian, who would then come to our services. So I think there's tremendous opportunity for English-speaking ministries around the world. And these congregations, in many cases, are very strong.
Where do you worship them?
This was a congregation that didn't own anything.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever the Eucharist was offered, that's where the congregation showed up to worship. And I thought that was something that we could learn a lot from in the United States. No brick and mortar problems. We rented an office downtown, met in people's homes for church activities. If we needed a fellowship hall for a church gathering of some kind, we'd rent one.
What do you do on Sunday for normal worship?
Well, during the years that I was, the congregation had done different things, but during the years that I was there, we used a Norwegian church downtown that was no longer, it was an old church that was no longer active, and it was kind of just sitting there. So the communa let us use it on Sunday mornings. It was strictly a sanctuary. It had nothing. It was in the midst of a big graveyard, and had called the Heptenkirke, beautiful old wood building, and served our purposes really well. But the congregation had worshipped around town in various places over the years, and so the church didn't seem to be crucial to its life.
It was the tie of fellowship that banded them together, yeah. Wasn't it? Not the location.
Right. Consequently, the congregation had a budget of a couple $100,000 a year, and they could spend all of that on a mission, the ministry. Mm-hmm. Gave away a huge percentage of it to mission causes all over the world.
What kind of causes?
Oh, everything from raising scholarship funds. So Malefi Zeli, this Lutheran pastor who was in jail for a couple of years in South Africa, could come to study at, they paid for a large portion of his first year at LSTC.
How about that?
To Habitat for Humanity kinds of projects around mm-hmm. different Kenya and the United States, various places around the world. They were involved with housing project in Haiti. They were involved with the resource center in Lebanon that's run, was started by a Lutheran pastor. His name escapes me at the moment, but for handicapped people and war victims in this shredded country of Lebanon.
Well, you had a rare opportunity to do things like that, didn't you?
Right, and people would study these.
Probably even visit them.
And try to visit them, right. Yeah. And then make a recommendation to our benevolence committee in the congregation. And so benevolence became a real exciting kind of venture in that congregation. They would raise the money largely through people's pledging, but they also had an annual auction when they would raise $15,000 in a single night just for benevolence projects. And,
mean auction off things or yeah, services?
Yeah, each other and crazy things, you know.
Yeah. So, well, made it fun. Yeah. Well, that sounded like you had a really unique experience there.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I've not seen that written up in any of the journals.
No, historically, as Lutherans, we've not been tuned into these congregations. We've been tuned into our own.
Yeah, Copenhagen, Berlin.
Right, exactly. The ones that we've got connections with.
Up in Stockholm.
Right, but I think in the history of the LCA, for example, there was only about three or four of our LCA pastors that served these congregations.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Carlson, who's still in the bond now, was one, and I was another, and there was a Pastor Courtray in Antwerp, and someone else their name escapes me at the moment, but we've had quite a few pastors serve overseas congregations where there is an ELC, where there was an LCA or ALC connection, like the ones in Scandinavia,
sure.
Berlin, Jerusalem, Cairo, yeah. And so forth, I would hope that more of our Lutheran pastors would consider, you know, those opportunities. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Now, where is Phil Nesbitt?
He is my successor.
I wondered if he was.
Yeah. Right.
You know, he spoke last week, 2 weeks ago, at his father's funeral.
Yeah.
Right. Came over. Very excellent message. Well, let's touch base about this fascinating community called Olden Village.
Yeah, let's do that.
When was your first visit up here?
1969.
You came in the early years. That was during Hinderle's.
Yeah, Carol Hinderle was the director of Poland. I have often characterized Carol as the King David of Poland. He really captured a vision for what Poland could be and instilled that in the place. And that vision, in my judgment, still carries Holden. I think Holden owes Carol a tremendous thank you for what he did here. He was the director here, I think, for about 13 years. And then in the late 70s, Fritz Norstad was interim.
Yeah, that's right. Just
for one year. And then John Tram was here for about 6.5 years in the late 70s and early 80s.
84, yeah, 84.
Yeah. And John did a tremendous job, too.
Were you here in those years?
No, I never was here. I had not met John until I came back to Holden this time.
Mm-hmm.
I was here several times during the time that Carol was here. And you know, Carol was a very bright man, and he loved to discuss issues and have all this good energy, and he could get a good debate started on any issue, and he'd take, you know, any side. And so
he could be a gadfly, yeah.
Yeah, he was wonderful, and he had a wonderful colleague by the name of Werner Jansen, who and they were, I think, a wonderful team, because Werner really looked after all the physical aspects of Poland's life. And that left Carol free to fundraise and to develop the program and be
exuberant
and be the enthusiast and so forth. Anyway, John and Mary Schramm came. We shouldn't forget Mary Kinderling too. I mean, she was a wonderful teacher, and the two of them were, you know, I think ideally suited for Holden. Then John and Mary Schramm came, and they had a tremendous passion for peace and justice issues, and they really inspired the village to begin to think about living more simply and ecologically responsibly and so forth. And so they shaped the village significantly during their years here around those issues and helping the village develop a lifestyle that was in harmony with those kinds of concerns. Then after John left, Elmer Witt was called as the director, and unfortunately his wife, Jenny, died just before they were scheduled to come to Holden.
Right.
That was a tragic loss. And Elmer was here for about 4.5 years then, in the mid-80s to the late 80s. And he brought gifts to Holden too. Elmer had a strong vision that Holden would be a place where people of all colors could come and participate.
Yeah, the rainbow.
So he started Rainbow on the Mountain. He insisted that women be visible in the leadership of Holden Village, and so we had village pastors. It was an example of how that worked itself out, one after the other, that were women, and continued to encourage the village to chew on the tough issues that were part of our day and our time. Then Elmer retired in 1988, and Paul Bowe was called to be the interim director. Paul, as you know, was another Lutheran saint,
yeah,
at least in my book. Had this long history of involvement with Native Americans.
Sure they did.
And
just what a good name.
Yeah, a great, great man. So he and Carolla were here until Jeanette and I came in 1989, in June. And so now Holden has embarked on a new chapter in its history. These chapters, I think, get shaped a lot by the issues of our day. Maybe as much as they do by the personalities.
But it's one of the rare places in the church where those issues may be articulated and debated.
Right. Very vigorously. And and sometimes the issues surprise you. You know, we had planned that this summer would be a major thrust on environmental issues, because we think this is the environmental decade, and we've got to make some decisions this decade about our partnership with creation, or we're not going to have any creation left to partner with.
Oh, true.
But this summer, the really tough issues in the village have been homosexuality, mm-hmm, which is a very divisive issue in our church right now. And Holden wants to be a place that has open conversation about these things. And I've discovered, frankly, that that's difficult for some of our, particularly some of our Lutheran people. They have a hard time either expressing how they feel openly or by being really uncomfortable with the tough issues being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think homosexuality is a really tough issue, because you're not talking about a... you know, you and I could debate about what Americans' foreign policy ought to be on a particular issue. But in a sense, it's kind of a distance from us, you know.
That's right. It's out there.
It's out there somewhere. But if one of us happens to be gay or the other lesbian and one of us straight, and we start debating homosexuality, we're talking about something that's very dear and personal to...
Right.
To one of us, you know.
We've absorbed a lot of attitudes from our early life.
That's right. So that's been an interesting issue this summer in the village. Also, the big issue is the church right now is. We're in a tough time on that issue in the church right now. Inclusive language always rears its head on that.
That's right.
And we have a lot of investment in the language we use about our relationship with God. And so, you know, these are just examples of some of the issues that have been kind of got people stirred this summer in Holden Village.
I could react quickly by saying that in 42 and 44, 46, I was the one that led the fight in the old ULCA to get the RSV adopted.
Oh, really?
Quietly behind the scenes in Seattle. It was a big debate, and then they voted to endorse the RSV, which meant a lot more than the educational materials.
Yeah.
Because that meant that it ought to be used in worship.
Right.
And that just pulled right out the rug out of the old Anglican oriented
Sure, the King liturgy. James.
Sure, because those were the settings used in all the songs.
Yeah.
But now I find myself, you know, content in that pattern, and I find that this linguistic shift really bugs me once in a while.
Yeah.
So I guess that I'm showing my 73 years.
Well, I'm not sure that we won't all think some of this is rather humorous, you know, in the end. But
yeah.
I mean, particularly the language stuff.
That's right.
But it. It does mean a lot to some people.
Yeah. Would I be being rude if I looked for some information?
Come right ahead. No, we're just chatting, making a recording.
We're making a
come
recording.
Come on in now, Barbara. Fine.
You're on our recording.
Yeah. No, come on. Let me ask a couple questions. What do you find the spirit of Holden today? I mean, you captured something of the Hinderleers and the Schramm and the others. Do you think that thread's still coming through?
Oh yeah, I think
spontaneity, I always felt, was a part of Carol's.
Yeah, Carol could celebrate anything, you know, the dedication of a new privy to a major renovation or a festival or whatever.
Yeah,
certainly humor is still hoped for all the time in the village. And I think a spirit of not backing away from the tough issues, so that people do have some place, at least, where we can go and talk about those and reflect together as Christians on what we should do about them and where we should go and how we should be involved and so on and so forth. Hopefully the village is also a place that demonstrates the possibility of living simply, of living in harmony with the environment, of at least trying not to be as consumptive as the rest of our society. A big theme that's demonstrated, of course, in the village is worship. We worship every day, 365 days, as a community here.
Yeah.
Sometimes twice a day, because we have comp line once a week, and often other services, often a tzei, contemplative service, or a healing service. And I think people come here and can catch a vision that worship can be fun and interesting and exciting and doesn't have to be dull and boring and laborious, you know.
A lot more variety here than almost anywhere you go.
Yeah, a lot of variety, something new every night practically, and different. I think we struggle to find here a balance between work and play and fun and contemplation and worship. Community constantly talks about that, about how to do that. During the winter time, for example, we'll have solitude days where nobody works in the community.
So there's a whole day when they're just quiet and reflection.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great exciting thing, really.
Yeah.
For me, it's a good. I wonder, I've reflected on Holden. Here you have no automobiles,
just essential vehicles,
right.
And no television, right. Not even radio.
Right. Well, we do. There are a few people that
have shortwave.
No, but they there's a few places in the village where you can get a station or two on a radio.
Okay.
So there are a few radios now.
Yeah, but not immediately available for everyone.
No, and no telephones.
And I have really reflected that that means that there is almost a medieval monastic quality of life here.
Yeah, there is. There is a monastic quality of life. I think if you take some of the values of a monastic community and overlay them on to Holden, you have an understanding in part what Holden's all about. One big difference, of course, is the fact that we have people of all ages here. We have families, we have single people, we have single parents.
Right.
So it's you take all those kinds of diverse people, and the covenant to worship daily and everyone to do the job that's assigned to them, and we share a lot of jobs together. I mean, everybody does dishes from the director to the youngest
right.
child that can possibly reach the counter to do them. And
that's a mark of many homes. You know, that in the average home, that's shared labor,
mm-hmm.
which means you've captured something in a larger community that normally is only for a single unit.
Yeah, right. Very much an extended family. We think of ourselves as a community. We don't think of ourselves as a camp. We don't think of ourselves as a retreat center. We don't think of ourselves as a conference center. And yet, all of those kinds of things, dimensions of those things, go on here. But we think of ourselves as a community of people that has this ministry of hospitality and this ministry of conversation. And we carry that on, and people are invited into that to be participants. So that's why you come to Holden, and even as a guest, people will be asking for volunteers to wash dishes or work in a snack bar or do this or do that. A lot of guests come to Holden and just work the whole time there.
Yeah.
That's their experience. That's the experience they choose when they're here. Or they'll divide it, do some work, go to some sessions, or they'll spend their time out in the wilderness. And Holden is clearly not a resort, although a lot of people come here for their vacations.
Yeah, but sure not plush resort. It's simpler.
Simple living.
I directed a young adult camp for 3 years in the Pocono Mountains.
Uh-huh.
And there I found that a lot of the guests were quite happy coming in and doing some work.
Yeah.
In other words, they feel that shows they're a member of it.
Right.
And you let that come through, and I think that's wonderful. Tell me, in the winter, does it really feel strangely isolated out here?
Yeah, I can feel very quiet. And that's one of the great gifts of the winter. The long-term community here is divided, I suppose, in their opinions about whether they like the summer better or the winter better. Probably depends on personalities, but
I guess.
But I would say many more like the winter better. I mean, they like the summer, but if they had to rate them, you know, what season do you like? They would rate the winter over the summer, and I that may be because Holden attracts a lot of people who are very contemplative. Kind of in personality, and then it attracts people who are very serious about their own religious quest. At least since I've been here, there hasn't been anyone that I'm aware of that really didn't come because they were really serious about their own journey. We have people who come from a variety of traditions. Christian traditions, and people who aren't Christian who come searching, and people who aren't sure what they are who come searching.
They want to examine it again. Yeah.
Right, but they're all very much into that kind of journey in their life.
Well, there is also an acceptance of people at whatever stage they are.
Right, I think so.
No judgment comes through, as I sense.
No.
I wondered about what it's like. Is it possible that the fact that three times a week a boat comes and you can go out means that you have the option of getting away?
Sure.
So that takes that anger up.
Yeah, sure. It's and we encourage people to get out of the village every 5 or 6 weeks for about a week. And
what provision is made to help them?
Well, we give them boat tickets, and there's kind of a value for that in the village, that every 5 or 6 weeks you take 5 or 6 days off.
Okay.
And
go wherever you like.
Go wherever
you have contact.
Yeah. And,
okay. Do you have a tie-in with LBI Issaquah so they could have room there as a base?
Well, they certainly have graciously offered that. We don't have any formal ties with LBI, although it's, as you may know, LBI was instrumental in the beginnings of Holden, and cooperated with the Holden, the newly created Holden board.
Right, they had a representative for Limeria.
Right, and LBI actually received the property from the House Sound Mining Company and held it for a while as this new board was getting organized, and then passed it on to them.
Have you met their new president?
No, I'm not. Trigg Skarstad.
Yeah, I was with him last week, went over to see him. And I heard him preach Week Go Sunday. I think you'd find him good. By the way, he's a historian.
Yes, I understand that. And everyone that's been through the village has spoken really highly of him. So I'm anxious to meet him. We are hoping to do a kind of first-time event this December, and that is to have LBI will have a interim here for a couple of weeks.
And, oh, great.
And he's planning to be the professor for the course. So,
that really pleases me. I was hoping. I guess as a historian, Scott, I want to see as much networking of our Lutheran institutions as we can
get. Sure, sure. So we would want that too. Any way that we can be helpful to LBI, and in they have a big challenge ahead of them now in fashioning a vision for their future, and
sure.
We can help them do that. Would you like to?
I wanted to ask, what theme do you think will be chosen for the year ahead? Is it settling down into one of several?
Well, it's clear that somehow or another, over this decade, the whole environmental justice kinds of issues, which often are colliding now with each other, will be a dominant theme. But I also think that we need to look at, again, at what the gospel means in light of those kinds of issues. So I can't tell you at this moment in time what our theme will be next summer, but I think it will have something to do with looking again at what the gospel is all about, and how that gets specific, or how that's related to issues like the whole environmental crisis and justice and so forth. And but how that specifically will tease itself out, I don't know yet.
Some people feel that one of the continuing needs at a place like this is the simple line of prayer, meditation, and re-examination of our spiritual commitment.
Mm.
And you feel that comes through in the worship and in the other options sufficiently?
Well, I think one of my gifts to Holden will be to move it in a more contemplative direction. Holden has been, in some ways, pretty cerebral.
Good.
And I don't think we want to lose any of that, the vigor of that discourse, you know. But I think we need to balance that with more contemplation, more reflection, more prayer. More of the right brain activities, more of the arts. We've always had a strong music involvement, investment, emphasis here. So I would see us trying to balance some of those things in the next years.
I think, my job as a historian is to listen, but I have to shift role and say I want to subscribe to that and encourage it. I always am puzzled how the flow of funds to keep this thing strong comes, and are the needs being met as go along these changes of leadership?
Yeah, I guess Holden is an example of how the Holy Spirit looks after us.
I think you're right. You're right.
It's been wonderful. The specifics are that about 75% of what it takes to run Holden is generated through the guests that come to Holden and pay their $28 a day, which is a very reasonable sum to be at Holden. That's possible because of the way Holden lives, quite frankly. The tremendous volunteerism that's here, the fact that we eat low on the food chain, and so our food budget is very low, the fact that we make do with used vehicles when we need them, and the fact that we don't owe anybody anything.
Generate your own electricity.
We generate our own electricity, and we recycle our own garbage, et cetera, means that for the numbers of people, over 6,000 last year that came to Holden, versus the dollars that it takes to run Holden, those ratios are way out of whack compared to everything else in our society.
Right.
We still, though, need to go out and raise $150,000 to $200,000 every year. That's raised largely from individuals that have been to Holden. We have a mailing list of about 25,000 families.
Wow.
And
that mailing's a big job.
Yeah. And so it's through the generosity of those folks who love Holden, who make an annual contribution, that the difference between what is received in revenues from the people who actually come to Holden and what is needed to keep Holden going, that's how that deficit is met. And so far, since I've been here, in this 15 months that I've been here, people are responding very well to Holden's needs.
I had a chance to chat with Mary Schramm, and I made a comment she got angry at. I said, you know, it means a lot to me to know that place of escape and a retreat and beauty is there. She seemed to get quite angry because she misinterpreted my point.
You mean about the word escape?
Yeah, because she thought that she and the others here were escaping from reality, and she tried to quickly tell me, no, they're in touch with the real world. And they say that wilderness within a country, to have some wilderness means something because you know it's there even though you don't get there often.
Right.
And I have a hunch it's that symbolic contribution that Holden has that makes it significant, at least I want to.
I think it's a very important part of Holden. That was always part of the monastic community. They were an island of prayer on behalf of the world, and I'd like to think that some of that that's an important image for Holden. Holden is an island of conversation and theological reflection, an island of prayer and worship on behalf of the world. In many ways, Holden is a lay academy, it's a lay seminary in a different form. It's true that all the issues all the issues of the world arrive at Holden's doorstep. Since our time is running out here, I just would say, too, about the wilderness aspect of it. I think, speaking as a theologian slash psychologist here for a moment, that the number one theological, psychological crisis today is the split between spirit and nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that this would be an issue that Holden would work at and symbolize in some ways, would be somehow the bringing back together of spirit and nature in this setting. So Holden, someone asked me, has Holden outlived its usefulness? You know, it's been in existence now 30 years. Is it something
of the past. And after being here for 15 months, I'm more convinced than ever that Holden may be just beginning in some ways to live its usefulness in the life of the world, the life of the church. So it's exciting for Jeanette and I to be here for a few years now and to be a part of this.
Well, I'm glad to get this story on tape, and as one who came curious, I want to affirm it's a healthy place, and it's a place with a purpose. And I'm glad you're here.
Well, thanks a lot, Russ.
God bless you. Keep it.
Thanks for interviewing me. And I appreciate, too, the work you're doing to preserve the history of our Lutheran Christian community. And we don't know enough about each other, and we live too much in isolation, as you say. And so the effort of you archivists and historians, I think, is really important.
I was glad to give it a recognition of what's been done up here in history, too.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks a million.
All right.